Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Relative Pitch. Today, we are super, super, super excited to have the one and only Kathy Lakuta, world-renowned composer, join us today. Kathy, how are you doing?
I'm great. So good to be with you. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. For those that are joining us, first of all, Kathy is one of my favorite people in the world. As we were just saying before we started recording, anytime me and Kathy is together, we're eating, laughing, having a good time. So I'm just so glad that she could join us and just, you know, talk about all the good things she got going on. So Kathy, can you just let our audience know, like, where you are, how did you get there, what was your inspirations and everything like that?
Oh my goodness, how many hours do I have for that answer?
And before you go, please tell everybody where you're joining us from and the time difference that is happening right now.
Yeah, so I'm joining from Brisbane, Australia. It's already future here, and it will always be. It's 11:30 in the morning on a Monday, and Anthony and the crew are in the evening of Sunday, the night before. And so, yeah, I'm speaking to you all from the future. So we can just establish that. Yeah. And that's one of many reasons I moved to Australia. But yeah, I'm a composer and pianist. Originally from Ukraine, I lived in the US for about 8 years, and now with all the touring that I've been doing, it probably is well over a decade that I've spent time in the US. And I moved to Australia in 2012 and been living here ever since. But I go to the US with tours two times a year, sometimes three. This year it will be five. So yeah, it's crazy. I started as a little pianist when I was 4 and a half. I started as a little jazz pianist, and then we added classical training onto that when I was about eight, and I started composing when I was a teenager, and never looked back. And I compose, but I also try to play piano every time I have an opportunity, mostly my own music, because I just don't have time to learn other people's music. And so I just play kind of what's already well familiar to me and part of my DNA. I write a lot for band, and I love writing for band. I love kind of writing my own music that's orchestrated for band, and but you know, not band music per se. I write for any medium, any instrumentation, pretty much. I write symphony orchestra works. I just wrote my first string orchestra piece, which was premiered in California earlier this month. Really excited about that. I am probably best known, in addition to my band writing, I'm probably best known as a horn composer. I don't play horn, but I've written now 28 pieces for horn, and just yesterday I put a double bar on a concerto for two horns in symphony orchestra. So that's a new contribution. So this is a little bit about me. I can you know, I can talk about myself for 2 minutes or 3 hours, depending on what you're after. So I can stop here and let's see what else I can contribute.
I first encountered your works. It was amazing. Yesterday, or not yesterday, last time I saw you with Anthony when we met you in Athens, is I first encountered your works in grad school with It Comes and Goes for brass quintet. And the Western Brass Quintet, which is where I went to school, performed it and was all amazing. I was like, oh my God, I don't know who this composer is. I just really love this piece. And then fast forward 3 years later, I get to meet you. And it was such, I was like, you know, worlds colliding. And when I love the part of like the profession we're in now, where we're like playing a lot more living composers. And then when you get to meet them, it's just like this little light bulb that comes on. It's like, oh my God, that's the person that like did this thing. And then we play this thing.
Yeah.
yeah. And when I, got the pleasure to meet you, and you came and you talked to the When Lit class, and about when Kathy says she's a pianist, like OMG, she like just got on the piano and just started playing these wonderful things, and she was like, oh yeah, I just made that up like right now. It was just something, and I'm like, Kathy, how does your brain work in this capacity? Because it is definitely not in mine. And the way, your formal training in piano in Ukraine is completely different from how things are in the States. Can you talk about that training and how that went?
Oh yeah, that's a great question. Thank you so much for your kind words about my piano playing. I think that if we were standing next to each other and conducting, you would have had a very different opinion about me as a musician. You're an absolute firecracker of a conductor. So if you were impressed by my piano playing, I was 10 times more impressed by your conducting.
Oh my God.
But the training in Ukraine was really fantastic. So it's very thorough, comprehensive, and when I did it, it was all free of charge. So I mean, when you do music school, when you're a school kid, you pay a little bit of money, but then the university education was free. So I did 7 years of music school. So in Ukraine, if you want to do an undergrad in music, you need to bring a diploma from music school. And in piano and violin, it's 7 years of music school. All the other instruments, it's five, except for double bass and tuba, which is 3 years. I had to do that, and it's your instrument, which mine was piano, but then you also have to do weekly solfege, music theory, music history, choir. So it's really just a fantastic after school activity and life where they give you all of these foundations. And then I did 7 years of that, and then I did my undergrad, which you cannot in Ukraine do in composition. You have to earn the right to study composition. So I did my undergrad in jazz and classical piano, and it was a 5-year program. I graduated from that summa cum laude, and towards the end of that, I started composing. And for the higher degree where you are allowed to start studying composition, and that one is also 5 years. They didn't have jazz piano, they only had classical piano, and I was not interested. And I really wanted to try composition, so I started doing composition. And then, if you are not, if you at that point, 5 years of undergrad, 5 years of higher degree, if you feel like you haven't been abused enough, you can go for a PhD, but it's only a 3-year program, and it's kind of short, and it's very scholarly based. It's usually for people who want to do just solid research. I don't know whether I would have done it there, but we left the country because my husband, who's also from Ukraine, he's a mathematician. He got into grad school at Cornell, and so we went to the US. But that's how the education there worked. And also, I will mention that in composition, this higher degree in composition, it's a 5-year degree, and it's structured just brilliantly. It's kind of like teaching the dancers to first stand with nice posture and then learning all the fundamentals of different techniques and moves, and doing stretching, and only then teaching them to dance and increasing difficulty. It was kind of like that, but with composing. So we were supposed to write a number of works, create a portfolio of works, but they didn't tell us just which works we needed to write. They told us when we should write each of these works. So first year, you learn to create material. So you write miniatures, you write simple ABA pieces, you use one or two instruments. They just really limit you with that. They just say you can't do more than that. Second year, you learn to develop material. So you write rondo sonata variations, and you can add maybe one or two more instruments if you really want to. Third year, you work with larger ensemble, woodwind quintet, brass quintet, saxophone quartet, string quartet, piano quartet, things like that. And then 4th year you write chamber orchestra and choir, and 5th year you write a large ensemble. And that kind of step-by-step approach, I found it to be absolutely fantastic. It gave me a really good foundation to lean back on anytime throughout my compositional career to date.
That's so interesting. You immediately started mentioning that you started off actually with jazz piano, right? And not classical piano. And that was kind of like this what you were really grounded in. And then whenever you didn't have the opportunity to do that, you went towards composition because I'm gonna be very honest, the only composition I've done has been for, I think, music theory courses. And it was terrible. It was not good. It was, no one wants to hear that. I always wonder what's the itch that composers get that's like you go past, what loving other people's creations and wanting to do that yourself. What really drew you into composing, and how has your jazz influence from that early age gone into your compositions?
All fantastic questions. Thank you. Yeah, I usually say when people say, "How did you choose composing?" I say, in an ideal world, you do not choose composing. Composing chooses you, and then you're screwed, but in the best possible way, you know. But it ha you really have to have that itch. You really need to not just, be full of yourself and think, "Oh, I can do this better," but you have to be like, "This is what I want to do every morning when I wake up and every evening when I go to bed. This is what I want to be finishing, a project." I couldn't really improvise in jazz, which is ironic because I use improvisation every day in my composing right now, but it's not jazz improvisation, it's a different kind of improvisation. But I thought that you just sit down and you improvise. Well, most people actually don't. They practice in all 12 scales, and they kind of figure out how to do it. I kind of missed that step. And then people were telling me, "You have to practice in order to improvise." And I was just saying, "God never gave me the talent." And they were going, "Practice." And I said, "Not meant to be." And they would say, "Practice." And I would, so I was in complete denial, basically just being lazy to put work into it. And I didn't want to just go with straight up classical piano because I felt like for what I wanted to do, it wasn't creative enough. And I also thought it was going to be too much work. Little did I know how much work composing is, but it's a different story. And then I was part of the curriculum at music college where I was doing my undergrad in jazz and classical piano was we had this jazz ensemble, and it was, your usual suspects: piano, saxophone, trumpet, maybe trombone, electric guitar, bass guitar, drum kit. And I was the pianist for it, and it was my best friends and I who were all classmates. And my gig as a mom of the ensemble was to listen to some famous recordings of jazz ensembles, of some jazz standards, and notate the improvisations. I had to notate the improvisations that other people played and put them into score so that we would imitate them, we would play them ourselves, and that's how we would kind of learn how to best improvise, that the how to create the most tasteful improvisations, I guess. And I felt like it was such a drag. It was a lot of work. And I thought, surely it would be easier to just compose something of my own. And I told my friends of that idea, and they thought it was a great idea. And so I composed three little pieces for us to play, and I brought them to the class. And I was 18 at that time. We start undergrad really early in Ukraine. I just turned 14 when I started my undergrad. And so I brought these three pieces, and they were basically pieces of crap, but to my friends they were the best music in the world. They were so excited about those because their best friend wrote it, and they were just raving about it. They were so excited, and I loved that feeling of, putting something, notes on paper. I didn't have a computer yet, so I couldn't hear the finale imitation of it or Sibelius. It was just me putting dots on the paper and then hearing those dots come to life with my best friends. And I just loved everything about it. And I thought, I would love to feel this way for the rest of my life. And that's how I decided to become a composer, basically.
Hearing your story about composition and just going back to something Lauren said about the only composition I ever created was in our music theory class. And just to note, I was going back through my random YouTube account and my composition was on my YouTube account and I listened to it and I was like, yeah, no, this is not for me. It is not for me. I was like, this sounds terrible. It's not making no sense whatsoever. But I will never forget, so, because I was just telling this story to one of my colleagues about how you compose, about how you hear these things in your head, and then you get your phone and you'll just like start saying what's in your head and putting it down and then going into your studio and then mapping it out. Like, can you talk about that? And like, because it was so interesting to me when I first heard about it.
Thank you. Yeah, so I use this method, which I coined in, during my PhD studies as premeditated improvisation. And basically, I like writing programmatic music. Not every piece that I write is programmatic, but most of them are. They either tell some sort of a story and some sort of an almost animation being run in my head, or just a more general idea. And it's always reflected in the title. So I always come up with the title first, and then that title gives me the inspiration for the music itself. And then I put all the ducks in a row, like what the instrumentation will be, difficulty level, duration, mood, through composed or separate movements, et cetera, et cetera. So these are all the ingredients that I put into my subconscious. And then I walk around and I think about it. And at some point, my brain tells me that updates are ready to be installed, and I either sit down by the piano or I take my phone and record myself. And it can be a pretty elaborate piano improvisation, or it can be just me saying to myself, okay, and so the saxophone will go blah 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 blah, and the trombone will go blah 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 blah. And I just talk myself through it until I get to the computer where I can notate that. I just record these improvisations, and then I get to them. And usually, if it's a piano, if it's a voice one, then I need to kind of play it on piano, because with voice I only have one voice. With piano, I get 11 voices, 10 fingers plus my vocal cords. So altogether, it's up to 11 pitches. And so the piano improvisation then serves often as a short score for me, depending on what I'm writing. And it helps me access my subconscious much quicker, because and not to get too bogged down on details, because I used to really suffer from looking for one perfect note. And then I studied with Steve Stuckey. I was really fortunate to study with the late Steve Stuckey just after he had won a Pulitzer for his second concerto for orchestra with LA Philharmonic. And I was complaining to him that it would take me a while sometimes to find the perfect note, and I needed the perfect note. And he looked at me and he said, okay, you do know that there is more than one perfect note for each situation, right? And my brain just exploded. And I thought, oh my God, there is more than one perfect note. That's right. Like, we have 12 notes to choose from, and then all the octaves, and then all the techniques and dynamics and everything. And I was just mind blown. And I've been using this approach ever since, that there is more than one perfect note. And these improvisations really help me get whatever perfect note is in that moment. And then, so I have to record them, and then I have to notate them as a dictation. And sometimes they're crap, so I throw them out, but sometimes they are exactly what I want it to be. And so, like, for example, in my band piece, Home Away From Home, there's this piano solo, which was recorded as one improvisation and notated note to note with dynamics, articulation, tempo changes, everything. It's just like when you see it on the score and you listen to that first recording of the improvisation that I played, that I didn't know what was about to come out of my hands. My subconscious knows, but I'm not, it's not an George Benson process where he plays on the guitar and sings the same thing. I have no idea what my hands are going to play right now. And so I then notated. And the fascinating thing to me is that sometimes I need a really fast moment. And, you know, for example, I need something that piccolos and flutes and clarinets will be playing like. I can't improvise that fast. You know, it's tricky and kind of keep an eye on the pitch or an ear. So I need to record myself slowly. However, I need to imagine what it's going to sound like. Fast. And so when I'm recording it slowly, it sounds really stupid. It's like wow, you know, like a really it's just like a slow-mo. But then I speed it up on my digital piano and boom, it's perfect. So it's a really fascinating process. It's a lot of fun, and I hope that magic never goes away.
Oh yeah.
I'm so interested in maybe like where else in your life you've pulled creativity for your compositions for. I mean, it seems like you've written so much, especially for the horn, I guess. I guess good for you, horns. I don't know. If you want to throw some love to the flutist, throw some love to the flutist too. But like I'm always also very interested in just hearing about like do you how do you like writing in terms of like do you sometimes see places? Or is there something you'll see just out and about, or an event will happen and you're like kind of using that as a framing? Or is that even how you go about that aspect of your writing?
I think it's a combination of all of that, and then some. It really depends on circumstances. Sometimes people will approach me and say, we want, when they approach me with a commission, they say, we want you to write a piece about this and this. And then I can tell them, yeah, absolutely. Or I can tell them, this is not for me. A couple years ago, a dear friend approached me and said that he wanted me to write a symphony about reaching nirvana. And he shared a book with me, and I read the book. And it was just really like it was a great idea, but it was just really not Lacuda. So I told him honestly that I think that he should approach a different composer if he's really determined to write about this topic. And at the same time, sometimes it's something that's kind of has to come out. For example, I wrote a piece called Lesions, which is about incurable illnesses and how people affected by those and their loved ones, how they deal with those. And that's inspired by my mother's decades-long struggle with multiple sclerosis, you know, and just for a while, I was feeling like I had to write something, I had to do something, and then I felt like, okay, this is it, this is the time. Sometimes it depends on whom I'm writing for. I always like to make a piece work for the people who commission it and somehow make it relatable to them. Home Away From Home, for example, was commissioned by Columbia University Wind Ensemble, and I asked their conductor Jason Noble to tell me about the band, and he said that they're mostly freshmen. And I thought, okay, that means in the US that they probably just left their parents' nest. They came on campus, they're finding new life, being in a dorm and finding new life on campus, first time in their lives, but most likely. And so it's about new beginnings and about home away from home, about building the new community. My very first piece for high schoolers, which everyone else is welcome to play, but it was kind of the consortium lead was a high school here in Brisbane. I wanted to write something about them as well, so it was my first grade four piece and first high school driven commission. And I started thinking about what they're into. I talked about to their band director because I said, you know, I am fluent in 8-year-olds at the moment because that was my daughter's age, but I don't know what the teenagers are like. And she said, well, they love these days, they love debating, they love talking about politics, they love talking about climate change, this and this and this. And I thought, Planet B. It's this, you know, because I saw maybe a week earlier, I saw on Facebook, take care of our planet. There is no Planet B. And I thought, okay, I'm taking a musical journey to Planet B and talking through music about climate change, about wars, about pandemics, and all that, and how this generation that's playing Planet B right now will be the ones who will be most affected by all the changes happening in our society in our on our planet at the moment. So things like that, it's a combination of everything. Sometimes it can be just walking around and seeing something cute and nice. Sometimes it's a story that happened to people for whom I'm writing. I have a piece which is my best seller called I Threw a Shoe at a Cat. And yeah, and it's based on a true story that happened to my dear friend Peter Love, horn player and my number one horn collaborator here, for whom I've written a dozen of commissions. And this story happened to him and his cat, and it just seemed like the most appropriate title, you know. Then the one of the most recent pieces that I've written was commissioned by Enchantment Trio from New Mexico State University, and they told me what they were doing. They told me the instrumentation, and they told me what they were doing, which is they wanted to do school outreach tours where they come to primary schools, and the instrumentation is horn, clarinet, and cello, which is the instrumentation for Lesions, the piece I mentioned earlier. Lesions was the first piece written for this instrumentation, and they played Lesions, and then they decided to create this ensemble and commission more works for this instrumentation. And they wanted to do these outreach tours where they would play handheld percussion and these three instruments, covering all the instrument groups within the orchestra: strings, woodwinds, brass, and percussion. And I thought, well, okay, so I want to write something cute for kids, but also these guys who are commissioning it are my dear friends, so I want to address that. And also they live far away, so I want to address that. And so I wrote this really cute and playful piece called Long Journey to Planet from Planet Xeno. And it's like these two soulmate friends who found each other, who were on a different planet, and then they landed on Earth at different corners of Earth, and they're traveling towards each other because they promised back on Xeno that they will find each other once they're on Earth, and it's their journey towards each other to find each other and reconnect, you know. So just lots of different things, and I really like to kind of hit all the boxes, connect the story and the intensity of the music and the topic to the difficulty level, to the target age of the players or professional level, et cetera, whether there is educational value in it or, yeah, blah, blah, blah. It's nonstop. I can talk about this nonstop as it seems.
I love it. I also just had a surreal moment because I forgot what chapter we were on in music appreciation that I'm lecturing on this week. And it's Stories Without Words. And I'm literally talking about your piece Lesions on Thursday during my lecture. And I literally was like, why does this piece sound so familiar? And I started looking through my lecture notes. I'm like, this is hilarious. The class is going to have a good time when I tell them. One thing I have a qu I've always wondered this with composers, because some composers love to pick time signatures that make me think a lot. And I
Yeah.
have thinking. So when you're like doing these the premeditated improvisation, and you're like doing the slow improvisation and you're just speaking things, do you think of a meter, or do you just you're just thinking
No.
phrases and stuff that comes out? So then when you sit down and you start notating, how do you determine like the meter? Like it comes and goes, changes meters so often. So like
Yeah.
how did you come about that?
Yeah. So when I start the improvisation, I kind of do in the name of the Father and Son and Holy Spirit and just hope that it's all gonna work out. I don't have a plan. But then yeah, I sit down and I just do my best to notate it dictation style in the meter that makes most sense to me. Sometimes it's I would, if I'm unsure, I would run it by conductors. There was a moment in my timpani concerto where I notated it in a certain, it was like 5+2 and 4+2. And then Nick Williams, who was doing the world premiere, he said, "This is really not working for me. I need this to be in whatever, 4/4 plus whatever is remaining." And it took me a little bit to wrap my brain around it. But I saw that the musicians were struggling a little bit and he was struggling a little bit. And so I realized that it's all in my hands to stop people from struggling. So I changed it the way he wanted it and it worked. And so it's, and I usually think about it this way. I can be imagining whatever I want, but at the end of the day, I have this added context because it's playing in my head. People who get the score, they don't have that extra context. They have the score, and the score needs to make the most sense to them. So I need to kind of remove myself from this situation and imagine what it's going to work like for a person who doesn't hear it in their head, whose first acquaintance with it is just by seeing the score. So, and then sometimes I can ask people for their opinion before I make a final decision. There was a moment in my Pete Berry and Rise where Jerry Junkin was doing the world premiere and he said, "This will really work better in 5/2 instead of 10/4." Done, Jerry, of course, changing it to 5/2. And so now it's in 5/2. Just things like that. And sometimes it's simple, sometimes it's more complex. One of my pieces, I had a lot of 7/4s, and the performers were complaining, even though all of those were 4+3. They were still complaining, so I had to change it all to 4+3. So, yeah, but I think for my approach with this is, when sometimes it all sounds very complex and complicated, but composers notate it in 4/4, it's like it with all the crazy accents, it just it's like it annoys the hell out of me as a musician trying to read it. So I feel like it's like with Ukrainian language, what you see is what you read. You just it all sounds exactly the way it's written. So I kind of like that approach with rhythms as well. Just whatever meter I hear, just put it in that meter. And then if people are complaining, I try a couple different things and I'm always happy to change it to make the life of performers easier, always.
I will say, as the conductor, Kathy, specifically Bear and Rise, when we were preparing that piece, I did one of the rehearsals, and I was like, Kathy, you're making me go through all of my beginning conducting, like, because it changes the time signature, especially when we get to the little fast part, and it has some things. And I was like, all right, Kathy, you're giving me my workout today. Thank you for that. But it really did fit very well, for the musicians and for the conductor that is up there. And by the way, I could totally hear Nick Williams saying, oh yeah, this just not working for me. I can hear him saying that as studying with them for 2 years. I can hear the tone he said it in and everything. Love Nick, love you, kisses, smooches. I wanted to go back to Home Away From Home and just, I was reading the notes about the piece and how you have called three places your home. And, how did you find, solace in the work calling those three places home as you move from Ukraine to the US, calling now US home, moving from the US to Australia, calling that home? How did you kind of synthesize that in your brain and in your normal day-to-day life?
Oh, it's right now it's all very easy because it's been 12 years since I changed homes, so you just get used to it. But keeping all these three places as homes, it's all about memories and friends that I have. And I still have a lot of friends in Ukraine, but I've made particularly so many dear friends in the US. And every time I go on tour, it seems like the list keeps growing, just like you guys. There are just so many wonderful, like-minded people to meet in the world. And I feel like it's easier for me to make those connections because I lived in the country, and because I do feel kind of patriotic about it, and I feel like it's one of my three homes. So, and not to mention that this year I'll spend half of my time in the US this academic year. So, but at the end of the day, there are a couple places that are really dear to me, like Ithaca, New York, for example. I would be happy to move there and just live there for the rest of my life, and I would be happy and excited. Traveling from there is not easy, but other than that, just absolutely love it. But it's all about people. And it's all about being feeling welcomed and loved. And I'm very lucky to have that in all three countries. And in terms of composing, it also made me kind of, I was saying that having moved continents twice and having to create the name for myself completely from scratch, where people had no idea who I was, where I was coming from, and persevering through that period kind of made me a compositional cockroach. I can survive like in nuclear war and just keep composing, and be able to kind of find my feet, hopefully. That seems to be the situation right now. So I think it made me stronger, and it broadened my outlook on life, and it made me even I'm outgoing by nature, but it made me maybe even more outgoing, and made me find really just wonderful, wonderful friends who are a part of my pretty big circle. And somebody said that I have a lot of besties. They said, shouldn't it be just one bestie? And I said, no, it doesn't have to be. I have bestest besties, but I have besties. Nick Williams is my bestie for sure. It's just these people who I would do anything for them. And if we pick up the phone now, it's going to be a 3-hour conversation. And before we even get to something that we had to discuss for work or for, So yeah, it's all about people at the end of the day.
I love that. And we talk about relationships so much on the podcast, especially when we're talking about music education and when we talk about going through college and the fact that we all found each other through school. And like those are very fundamental time periods of a person's identity, is like that early stage of young adulthood. And when you talk about this piece, and how you wrote it for freshmen in that mindset, it is so true. When you're a freshman leaving home for the for many of us, well, we all, left home when we came to KSU to do our undergrad, and it's the first time you discover no one's going to tell me to do laundry, no one's going to tell me to make my bed, no one's going to tell me to clean my room, and no one's going to tell me to do my homework, no one's going to tell me to go to class. And you really learn so much about yourself during that time, but you also meet people along the way who, like, sometimes they will help shape you, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. But if you're lucky, you have people who are there to motivate you, to push you, to, they know when you need a shoulder to cry on, but they also know when they're, you're like, hey, you can be doing more. you could be doing better. I'm going to challenge you to do better. So I love that you mentioned that. And we always try to stress on here, especially to young people listening, like relationships are the core to who you are. No matter what field you go into, what you want to end up doing, don't burn bridges. Always see people, first of all, as humans, but also see them as a lesson. There's a lesson always in people. I mean, even someone at the coffee shop who just may have just brushed past me the right way. They said, "Oh, I love your scarf." I'm like, "Oh my God, thank you." Like, and that just brightens
Yeah.
that. You know, it's those small connections that really can mean so much. So I love that you're putting so much thought into your composition when really shaping these pieces for specific identities. And like you're talking again, moving from place to place to place yourself. You absolutely have to know, first of all, know yourself as an individual to be able to do that and to feel confident in yourself, but then to know how to build and maintain relationships. So, like, kudos to you for that, truly. It's
Oh.
an inspiration.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, I was saying, I've been saying lately that, it sounds kind of the it kind of contradicts itself, but my kind of business model is just being a nice person who happens to compose, and I'm giving the knowledge that I have and the experience that I have, I'm sharing it very happily when I'm at residencies and I'm working with composers and performers and students. I put myself into their shoes because I remember what it was like when I was a student and I would get stuck for the first time and all that. But the number one thing is just being a nice, genuine person and being yourself, but working every day to be the best version of yourself. I never go like my mother-in-law does, well, this is just who I am, and you have to accept me for this. Well, nobody seems to care, So make sure you're a nice person and then offer that to the world, because there's only one of the world needs one of each of all of us, and be yourself because everyone else is already taken. So that's the kind of the ideology that I really like for my own life, that makes me really comfortable in my skin, and that I like sharing with the world and with students, especially these days when there seems to be so much anxiety about identity and it's just with the social media and everything, technology. I feel like being comfortable in your own skin is something money can't buy you, and even education can't buy it for you, really. And other people cannot give it to you. It has to come from within. So I think that helps you be a better composer, a better conductor, a better musician, a better person, and a happier person, and a person who gives more to others.
One thing I can always say about you, Kathy, is you are a true, genuine person. And especially when people, whether you're a famous instrumentalist, whether you're a famous vocalist, whether you're a famous composer, I'm always so interested when I meet some people because, sometimes we get in our heads and we develop an ego. And when I met you, it just felt like it was so natural. And I just loved just connecting with you and how you were, vulnerable talking about your works and talking about your life to us as if now we're on the journey with you. And I want to bring up Berry and Rise because, that piece, it means a lot. And you talking about that piece, it opened the door, as you said earlier, what's in your head, you wanted to come out in the score, but when you just told your truth and what it meant to you, it really opened the door for us to interpret what you put on the page. And I want to ask you, when it comes to pieces like that, which means a lot to you, how is vulnerability a play when you're composing things like Berry and Rise?
I never really worry about sharing my story or sharing who I am, sharing what I have to say. I feel like it's important. I feel like there are people who always people who can relate to it. And that has been the case with Lesions, for example. Every time Lesions is performed and I'm in the audience, there will be four or five people who would come to me, and it can be a recital of all Likuta music or a recital of chamber pieces by different composers. But every time Lesions is performed, people will find me in the audience and come to me and tell me how they related to Lesions, that their dad had cancer or they have diabetes or something, something, and this piece really speaks to them, that they can hear things in this piece that they make their own. And that's just like, as an artist, there's nothing better than that. And it's really hard for me to listen to Lesions sometimes. When I was writing it in 2017, my mom was at a certain stage of her fight with multiple sclerosis. And then every time it was performed, her multiple sclerosis was progressing further and further because we didn't catch it early, so she didn't get any treatment. And now she's passed. And so every time it's like it's in you it, like it, they say you can't walk into the same water twice. It's kind of like that with Lesions. Every time I somehow related back to my mom in a different way. But I'm so glad that I wrote this piece when I wrote it, and it's a time capsule for that. And I'm so glad that I was as sincere emotionally as I was, even if it makes me sob, you know. And also with writing music like this, there are a lot of people who don't have that outlet to share these stories, and I do, and I feel like I can, I can share something that they can relate to, or they can kind of speak their truths through my music. And that's really special. I had a recent experience with Berry and Rise. It was performed here. We had a consortium premiere in Brisbane on October 4th, and I invited some Ukrainian people who I know in Brisbane, and this lady who's a friend of mine, she couldn't come, but her parents came. They never met me before, but they immediately saw me in my Ukrainian shirt. They came to me, they gave me flowers, they gave me a hug, and they were seated next to me. And so the dad was seated across, so it was me, then next to me was my husband, and then this the father of that family was sitting. And I came out on stage and I talked about the piece, and I said how in the opening this theme comes in, and it's a Ukrainian peaceful snowy night, but there is the feeling of the impending invasion about to unfold. And then towards the end of the piece, I was then talking about the piece for like 4 minutes, and then I said, and towards the end we have that same theme come back. But there is no evil in the air anymore. It's optimistic, it's peaceful, it's calm, you know. And then we were listening to the piece, and about 13 minutes into the piece, this second version of the theme of this Ukrainian village theme comes back. And this father of the family went over, like around my husband, and patted me on the shoulder. And I looked at him and he said, "This is the peaceful one, right? Everything is okay now, yes?" in Ukrainian. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay, good." And it was just such a meaningful moment. I almost felt like crying. And I think I will remember that for the rest of my life. And but he could really relate to it because he had to flee Ukraine pretty much around the invasion time. And so it was something that we shared through this music, and he understood what I put into those sounds, you know. So it's pretty special.
Wow. And when talking about Berry and Rise and how it is taking on a life of its own, and it's in now this kind of especially teaching music appreciation and music history. And we talk about songs of war and songs of protest, and I think of Berry and Rise and the what it reflects and how, you know, it took you to write that. How long did it take you from when the invasion happened to synthesize this information of what's going on to, you know, in your home country before you could write something down? Was it an immediate, you know, you went right to writing, or did you have to take some time before coming up with something?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I was just glued to the computer and to the TV when the war started and everything was happening. It was just absolutely surreal. And then my mom passed on the 9th day of the war, and then I couldn't write anything for 10 weeks, I think. And then but and I had a lot of suppressed memories. Oh, from the start of the war, kind of around the time my mom was dying and when she did. And when Kim Campbell from Dallas Wings, who's now my manager, when he contacted me and said that they wanted to commission a piece from me about the stoic spirit of people of Ukraine, he said, "Look, I totally understand that you might not emotionally and mentally be in the place to write about the war or people of Ukraine." And I said, "No, it should be fine." And I did a lot of crying and I did a lot of healing through this piece. I didn't realize how much I actually needed this piece to go back and face all those events and memories and get through them and kind of heal as best as one can. Because there were moments where I kind of wanted to go through the war, through that first year and a bit of the war, in the music. And there were moments where I just completely blacked out. I could not remember what was happening because my brain completely suppressed it. So I had to come to my husband and say, "Please remind me." And he was completely on top of it all. He was following the news the entire time. And so I was reminded about everything, and I kind of managed to grieve through it. And there was lots of tears, and there's a lot of emotion. It's probably my most emotional piece, but I feel like it was such a privilege as a composer and as a Ukrainian to have that opportunity to outpour everything that had to be poured out into this piece, and now share it with the world. Share it with the musicians who are playing it, because it has elements of Ukrainian folk music, to which they most likely had never been exposed before. And you know, it broadens their horizons as musicians and as humans. And it's just yeah, special for me in every level.
Love that. Well, you know, Kathy, I would just have to say, if you ever want to write a piece for a flute player, a trumpet player, and a conductor, we Relative Pitch would be the people for it, okay?
Yes.
Oh,
Well,
God.
how about we divide and conquer? How about a piece for flute and trumpet and a piece for a conductor? Because
Okay with that.
I try to write pieces. Like, I have a piece for Schubert Octet plus piano, which I wrote with no conductor in mind, so that people can put it together quicker.
Yeah.
And if I write a duet with a conductor, that's going to be going in the opposite direction. But these guys can play probably a special someone. There's
Oh,
versions
yeah.
with flute and there are versions with trumpet, but I think we can make it work with trumpet and flute.
Ooh, well, there we
Oh,
go.
I'll
Kathy,
have a look.
yes, please do. Kathy, it has been a pleasure having you on with us and just talking about all the wonderful things that you're doing. And for our guests that are listening, how can they find you on social media and things like that? How can they find your music website? Please let us all know.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it's been such a pleasure chatting with you all, and thank you so much for knowing my music and for your very kind words and your love. And I love all of you back, and I can't wait to see you in person next time. I am pretty easy to find. There's only one Kathy Likuta on Facebook, and I'm pretty active on Facebook. I have a professional page there, which is Catherine Likuta, composer, and my website is Catherine with a C, CatherineLikuta.com. I have a YouTube channel, I have SoundCloud, and you can always message me on Facebook Messenger. I'm very approachable, and yeah, always happy to hear from anyone. And YouTube is a good place to start, I guess, because you can not only, hear my music, that's half of it, but you can see and hear the wonderful performers who are putting days and days and days of hard work into playing my music and counting, all the counting. Oh my God.
Well, we so enjoy having you on, and please, to all of our Relative Pitch family, please go check out everything Kathy Likuta has to offer. She's wonderful, amazing, and just a well person. That's what I love about Kathy Likuta. She's just an amazing person. So thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you
Bye.
so much. Bye.